Hi, and welcome to this first podcast on the introduction to software engineering. A while ago, I had a chance to sit down and have a chat with Mr. Christian Engblom from Ericsson, Finland. Ericsson, as you know, is one of the largest telecom network providers in the world. And in Finland, they have done an interesting transformation from a waterfall traditional organization to an agile organization using Scrum in a product program with about 400 people and 40 Scrum teams. The transformation has been going on for several years and is considered one of the best within Ericsson. And Mr. Christian Engblom, with whom I had the chance to talk, is a member of the Ericsson Finland R&D management team. He has been with Ericsson since 1979 and held different roles as project, product managers and line managers within the R&D as well as the market unit. Currently, he's a driver for the lean and agile transformation within the R&D organization in Finland. And in addition to that, he is also actively involved in the lean and agile change that goes through the entire Ericsson world. First, a bit of history. So could you, Christian, with a few words, tell us something about Ericsson and about the Finnish part of Ericsson?
I guess Ericsson is pretty familiar as a company doing telecom switching, mobile communication systems, way over 100 years old company, quite an achievement since roughly the 70s, 1970s. Switching has turned software more and more. Ericsson has started software development somewhere in the 1970s and being learning and evolving the process since that. Ericsson Finland R&D Center was founded in 1971. And actually since day one, we also got involved in the software development. It really came up to speed only from the beginning of 1980, where the software development began here. I've been in one or another way involved ever since. I guess in the beginning it was very much ad hoc processes, try and see and correct afterwards. Then the project culture started to evolve, and since mid-80s, Ericsson as a company has been fine-tuning a very, very strong project-oriented way of waterfall project-driven, top-down-driven software development process and model.
So to give a bit more of context, could you tell something about the size of the organization and the product?
The product is a mobile core network node. It's been developed since late 1990s, holds some, I guess, around 50 million lines of code, and also some dedicated specific hardware development. It's an Ericsson in-house platform, which it's built on. It's been developed currently in three locations. When we started the transformation, we had two locations plus the platform development. Have a big market share in the mobile network, around 50%, meaning that we have over 300 customer networks, mobile networks around the world, which we are serving. The number of nodes delivered today is somewhere around 7,000 or so.
How many developers are involved in the organization that you transformed from waterfall to agile?
When we started the transformation, we were somewhere a bit below 500. Now it's not purely only developer, it's the whole organization with support supply people and other support functions. Today, okay, now we have got in some new sub applications to the same product, so we are not far from the same figure today, but we were down at somewhere a bit below 400 before we started to grow again.
Before the transformation, you had a process model called PROPS.
PROPS as a project framework, it's the overall process which we followed and was the basis for the waterfall model, where you have a heavy study phase in the beginning, then you freeze the scope very early when you have understood the requirements, assuming that this is it and nothing will change, and then you have a heavy long project going some steps, maybe some iterations, but mainly so that you first do the study phase, then you do the implementation, then you start testing and have the big bang and problems at the end. This process, we here at LMF were fine-tuning, learning, developing, building an organization that somewhere in around 2005, 6, 7, we were very good at doing according to that, as good as you can be in that way of doing. Then we come to a situation where we saw that this is still not quite good enough.
So what were the problems that you saw?
four areas where we saw the challenges. First of all, as I said, the props model states that you, at an early stage, make an investment decision. This is the scope that you want to develop. And the scope almost always turn out to be quite big, meaning that the lead time of the project will be very big. Very typical was that it took us from kind of agreed requirement handshake to delivery. It could take 2 years. And that was good enough in the 90s, where there was a big mobile network build-up period, and anything we could deliver was good enough, so to say. This gradually changed, of course, and 2 years of stable, non-changing surrounding, that's not today's business. Also, we needed to fine-tune the scope so that it's much more flexible. The props model also held within the kind of requirements baselining and very strict change control systems. And when a change came in, it took us really a long time to figure out, can we do this? How can we do it? What will it lead to? It could take us 2-3 months even to come up with a new one, so that no, we cannot do it. And that was definitely not good enough. So of course, shorter lead times would ease up the pressure on the change handling, but also a different way of handling change altogether was clearly required.
So you said there were four areas in which you had problems. So one was lead time.
It's the value. Do we deliver the right value when we deliver? The other one was responsiveness, the change handling. They are very closely related. Third one was the quality. We didn't really have kind of severe quality problems in our networks. It's not an alternative in this business to have that. But it came with a too big cost for us. The waterfall, what it leads to is quite big bang effects at the end of the project with very, very heavy, costsome and cumbersome testing period. And what we saw happening was that our test surroundings, test sites, they kept growing. We were forced to hire more and more people into the testing phase. This was kind of a evil wheel, like it didn't really help, but we thought it helped. And then we added more and more and things almost worse only. And the distance in time between having implemented something in code before testing kept growing, meaning that also that the cost for fixing kept growing and so on. Test surroundings, test efforts, cost for doing things, lead times of fixing, everything kind of went in the wrong way. So that was the third one. The fourth one was motivation factor within our teams. We were organized in component teams in test different. We had our testing divided in different test phases, so there were different test phase teams. So you were specialized on doing this low level testing for that module of code, for instance, and that was what you were doing. You were good at that, of course, but it was quite narrow, and there was no really room for you to grow and learn more. You had a very limited view of the total big picture, meaning that also you kind of didn't have the opportunity to contribute with more, even if you would have wanted. So those were the four things we saw. And of course, then when you look at the lean and agile theories, you very quickly find good theoretical answers.
Where are we in time here when you felt that, hey, we need to do something?
The awareness and understanding of our situation started to grow 2007-2008. And somewhere mid-2008, serious discussions started within the organization. Started from the management team, where we saw these challenges and the problems. Then maybe it took some months before we gathered more people around and involved more and more of the organization to figure out how can we change this and how should we go about.
So why agile?
I guess there are many opinions, many views within our organization on why agile. One thing that to me was kind of so obviously much better was that we do not work in narrow silos with component-based teams. We create cross-functional teams trying to span end-to-end. And we try to create a continuous discussion dialogue with a Scrum States and Agile States product owner, but with the customer, with the product management, to ensure that what we are doing are the right things. Also, I think when building quality, one thing that we did understand from the beginning was that our old way of doing a big pile of specification, I think the worst examples I've seen is a 500 pages of feature implementation study that is from systems management handed over to design that please implement. And you can imagine that was not very easy to kind of get right. Agile then talking about communication over documentation, and that felt so very right because I've experienced all the challenges with document-based handover processes. Only later we understood this with the quick feedback loops, continuous integration. That was kind of that we didn't grasp from day one.
What were the benefits that you were looking for with the transformation?
More people seeing a bigger picture, opportunity for learning, more communication throughout the flow. We didn't talk about flow at that time. It has come along later on and so on.
Most agile models, and in particular Scrum that you adopted, is developed initially for small teams working tightly together. So how do you scale that up to a large organization with tens of teams?
We understood from the beginning that the Scrum by the book is one team, one product, one customer, and straightforward, and there will be challenges in scaling. But we haven't had little clue of how kind of big a challenge it really is to start fine-tuning this machinery. So it is, we are some, I think today, somewhere between 40 and 50 teams working around the same software base.
Could you very briefly walk me through the major stages in the transformation?
The first stage was what kind of started 2008 and continued a year, probably a little bit more. It was a kind of a phase where we understood that Agile first and then Lean and Agile will give us tools to do better. Of course, coming from the waterfall planning driven world, thought that we could make a master plan, that this is how we will do the change and this is how it will look like. And it took us quite a while to understand that, okay, we will not be able to do that. And with some external help, then we got started. And the first concrete thing that happened that was that we formed the first team in October 2009. And that was the first phase. And this, the fact that we had an ongoing project, part of that project was lifted out into one cross-functional team. It was one feature that we developed. That kind of hit the organization quite hard. Actually harder than we believed. We thought that it would be quite straightforward to have the team going, some sprints, learn something, get some experiences, and build the bridge between the new and old ways of working. But very soon we saw that working in this way, in 2 weeks, time boxes, in a surrounding that is tuned for a huge waterfall-based project, it simply doesn't work. And we ran into a lot of practical tools, lead time challenges that it simply wasn't really possible for the team to produce something in the 2 weeks time boxing. And it took us a couple of months, maybe even more, as an organization to understand that why is this? The team could very clearly say that, okay, well, the build times are too long, the test suites are so heavy that it takes the 2 weeks to run the test suites and all kind of these kind of challenges. And then we didn't really have the tools to what can we do about it. And it was a heavy learning for us to understand the real problems beyond kind of the symptom and then start do something about it. But this, on the other hand, then led us into the path of continuous integration to understand that challenge, to work down our build surroundings, to improve that, fine-tune that as far as to a perfection. Where we kind of, in a waterfall model, it was really not a problem that the build of a load module could take a couple of hours. Now, in a two-week sprint, if a build takes 2 hours, then everything is gone, spoiled. It's not an option. So we have really done a lot of work to improve this. And now we are down to kind of, we're talking minutes and even less for build times.
So you have come very close to continuous integration and some continuous testing.
Yes, we have over time developed our continuous integration routines and mechanisms to something that to me is quite close to a good machinery. We run on low level, the developers will get on kind of load module testing, basic testing level feedbacks within minutes, seconds even. All the teams have access to real hardware, real test surroundings where washing machines running, where they get feedback from a real surrounding, minimum within 2 hours after they commit new code. We run nightly load tests to a quite extensive load level, and every week run an even broader kind of system level verification in a kind of real network setup.
So you have several levels of pretty quick feedback on product quality that is always available to the teams.
Yes, and I think that is really, really a key for getting the quality in place and getting the speed up in the organization. You need to ensure that you have a working kind of surrounding all the time.
How did you go about forming what you now call cross-functional teams, these 40-50 Scrum teams that you have?
When we started, we knew what we had ahead of us feature-wise. So we could, with the knowledge of that these are the features we would do, choose, combine the teams in a way so that there was a fairly good match between competence and requirement. Of course, there were, as in any product, there are the critical components, the difficult components, the more central components, where the deep knowledge is a scarce resource. So what we added here, concept of component guardians. So we named quite a big number, actually, of component guardians. Those guys with the deep and maybe a bit narrow, but very deep knowledge, understanding of certain components, of certain functionality that are available for the teams to consult when needed to help the learning curve. So that was one part. And of course, every team, we made sure that they include people with a system understanding, a broader understanding, and then as broad understanding of the product components as possible, plus also enough testing understanding. The product we have, there are three different dimensions of it. There is an OTM part, which is a certain type of domain, knowledge domain. There's a device plane part, which is another competence domain. And then there's a control part, which is a third domain. So teams in the beginning were a bit dedicated to these groups. Still, there is a dedication between OTM and control is more and more merged together into teams, but the device plane is still a little bit more different, and not every team can go over these borders. But we have an integration organization which supports the teams with building up the continuous integration, but also with some specific testing competence in testing the feature, integration of the features and so on, where we didn't have enough competence to spread up in every team. And this is something we are right now working on, because this is clearly a bottleneck in our organization today. So we are trying to build over this bridge.
What about Scrum Masters? Where did they come from?
They come from many different backgrounds. Some of our former line managers were Scrum Masters. Some project managers became Scrum Masters. I guess that was the most common. Then we have some other support functions in there were some quality manager roles also going into Scrum Master roles. Now we are more and more having also developers, team members taking a Scrum Master role, which I think is a good development. A good Scrum Master, when you start this transformation, is really, really valuable. And kind of good coaches in general, whether it's a team on a team level and an organizational level, those who see the big picture and support, help and explain to people how should we work together so that things run smoothly, then that's really what you need in order to succeed. In order to be a Scrum Master, you need to have a genuine interest for the soft aspects, the people aspects, to enjoy working with people, with teams. You need to dare to challenge the teams, and you need to be also humble enough to understand that things don't usually happen as you wish them to happen. You need to be patient. And of course, the more you then understand the product, of the process, the ways, the tools, the surrounding you have, the more tools you have to use when coaching the team. Definitely, and we still to some extent wish that we would have more good coaches. Scrum Masters, I think we are fairly well off now. After a while, organization gets going and there starts learning, the role of the Scrum Master becomes a little bit easier. That's also a little bit a matter of opinion. How much dedicated power do you want to put on team level to push the team to improve? And how much does it really come from the team itself?
Okay, so let's talk about the product owner role. This is something that basic Scrum, it's already pretty difficult, but how do you scale and make a product owner work in an organization with tens of teams?
We understood that we need to scale this role. First, we started from the assumption that the product owner, there must be one person with the final word. Otherwise, you kind of don't get the decision. And so we had that, but we understood that that will not be enough. We have many teams. We have 30, 40 teams from the beginning. He will not be able to interface the teams. So we talked about the product ownership, which is a product owner team headed by the main product owner, or the product owner, as we call him from the beginning, and then with the support of a number of product proxy owners, where the thinking was from the start that every feature will be handled by one product proxy owner, and he will interface all the teams that are involved, whether it's one team or several teams. For big features, this task was split between several product proxy owners, so one feature could be handled by more than one product proxy owner.
How many teams can one product proxy owner handle?
It depends on the maturity level of the organization, but if it's more than three, then it starts to become difficult, at least. In the beginning, one product proxy owner per team is a good start.
As you mentioned, you have a large number of teams. How did you handle communication needs between the teams? I think that is something where basic Agile and Scrum doesn't help very much.
Yeah, and I guess that's one of the main challenges when you scale up, that how do you really make things fit together? And a basic Scrum offers the Scrum of Scrums, which is a pretty simple process, which is clearly not enough. We started off with that, but we saw that doesn't help us. It doesn't solve the scaling problem. If you have two or three teams, it might, but 30 teams, that doesn't really help. So we, in combination with creating communities of practices on a feature basis, we also divided the whole application into areas, which are kind of logical nodes, happens to be in our case, where we have area level communities of practices, and then also we can have feature level communities of practices, where we openly invite everyone. Of course, it's a team working with a specific feature, it's the product owner involved in a specific feature, but also other people, other teams that are impacted by this doing are openly invited to all the COP meetings. And it's also possible for anyone to call for a COP meeting when they see a need to sort something out. And this community of practice structure is also heavily used in the beginning of the features for agreeing together on the technical solution. How do we do things? So you have a common thinking and understanding, this is what we are going to do, and this is on high level how we are going to do it. And only after that you start documenting things. So it's a way also to avoid the document handover problematics, to really make sure that people talk together, agree together what and how we are going to do things.
One thing I think has been fascinating with your transformation is how you transform the physical workspace. You used to work in a traditional office with everybody in their own rooms, and where you even seated according to functions, so testers seating together.
Yes, that's correct. We were seated in one, two persons rooms, test organization that was situated, I guess, in this big building as far from each other as possible. Some 500 meters or so. They had a kind of this kind of cubicle room, open landscape, but still very boxified into cubicles. This was something that we also from day one understood, that if we want good team cooperation, we need to change this. And we had a good opportunity with a old hardware testing lab that was emptied out, and we could make a trial. Actually, what we did was that we let the first team that we created set up their own team space and try out and see how it works. What they did was that they had one long table with seats on both sides, and the first team had eight people in it, and they were sitting four and four on one each side facing each other. They were happy with the setup, and they had around there, they had plenty of whiteboard space. They had some sofa stuff and things where they could kind of stand up and sit down in a more relaxed surrounding, or stand up with the whiteboards and draw and discuss. And they were very happy with it. It seemed to work very well. So we decided, since we have our testing IETV organization was situated, as I said, in this cubicles world, which is the old factory building here, where we had the possibility to empty everything out. So there are a lot of open floor space. And then we created these copies of this first team surrounding with one big table with eight people. Now we have nowadays a bit smaller teams now. And then whiteboards around the walls being the separators between the teams. it was extremely good thing that we understood to do this, because it was also, it gave the team a good surrounding to work in, but it also was a so clear change to everyone that there was no doubt that things are changing now. It was a good signal, but also the thing that through which the biggest change resistance was channelized. This new seating with all my colleagues directly here, seeing me all the time, listening to me all the time, where's my kind of own space here, and so on. That created a big dialogue in the organization.
So could you describe the overall layout and solutions and how you came to build such a space?
As I said, it's an old factory building with a lot of empty room. It was renovated some 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, where we created common areas where it was possible to have meet in bigger groups. And these have, especially one of these open areas is very big, so we can fit in the whole organization there. And it's extremely good. We have used it often for open space sessions, but we have had the possibility to roll in whiteboards, flip charts, gather all the people, have an open space session, and leave the stuff on the walls for everyone to see and remember afterwards. We have around these big open areas, and in the middle of it, we have open areas where we have the team spaces. And we have tried out a little bit different groupings. We started with having the development teams, cross-functional teams in kind of together. We had the PLM, the back end, customer support, trouble report teams in together in one end. Then we had the integration gang together in one place, and we had the release verification guys together in one place, and the feature integration in one place. A little bit of functional setup, and which functions are close to each other was a question we didn't really understand from the beginning. So we have been moving around. Now we have the release verification, the integration, and the support supply guys. They are close to each other. They have the easiest access to each other, which is a good thing, because that's back-end flow is very much there. And then we have the feature integration and development teams close to each other, because there we have one of our bottlenecks. They need integrate to each other more by having them close to each other. It helps. So we do some iterations every now and then. And anyway, of course, if you have 300-400 people, everybody cannot be close to everyone. I guess as soon as you are further than two steps away, then there is a distance.
This sounds like you are very much in a mode of continuous improvement.
That is something that we have learned. The thinking here is that we are not done yet. We see the challenges we have and try to address them from all possible dimensions. And I guess this is something that if things goes well, you kind of are able in an organization even of this size to build a somewhat common vision that this is the way we want to go, and we want to improve all the time, and we enjoy challenging the status quo. We all the time kind of look for opportunities, and the thinking is all the time there, continuous iteration in the thinking around this. Then of course the changes will have to be also aligned with the operational pressure of delivering right here, right now. So you need to have that balance also in mind all the time. You can't break things too heavily, too quickly, and without thinking either.
Yeah. So to me, it has been an extremely impressive feat that you have undertaken here. Would you be able to comment a bit upon how much you have improved, or what kind of achievements you think you have gained benefits from this transformation compared to the old way of working?
We are often referring to Toyota and the management there, saying that they don't look at numbers very much. They just look at things are changing and improving to the better. The fact that you continuously improve is more important than the number that you achieve. And there's a thinking, there's an understanding that things take some time and all the improvement doesn't come day one. But we do have calculation. I've For instance, I've calculated what we've saved in pure administrative cost in handling trouble reports simply by not needing to write down that this is an error here and there and please correct, but being able to talk directly over the table and give you feedback to the guy who has made the mistake. We know that our history, every trouble report ticket that we write entering the system will cost us 50 man hours of work to administrate. During the first big project, we saved amount of trouble reports dropped by 50%. And if you turn that into money, it's 1 million euros. That's pretty much. Also, I've followed our project releases all the way from the beginning of the product and trying to roughly calculate average cost per feature, understanding that every feature is kind of, they are not comparable, they are different. But in average, they are in average the same. So there we've seen really, really big improvements in what one average feature costs us. And now, of course, there's on one hand, we have come a bit on the way in introducing minimum marketable features. So yes, the features are smaller, but still if you see that every feature is a sellable license, so value-wise, it depends on the pricing. They could be exactly comparable even if you price them equally. A lot more sellable items out and the release frequency has more than doubled. Actually, we are today in a situation that if things go as planned, we are able to release and ship a new delivery with 3-4 weeks notice.
But still you can see major improvements in the major areas that you mentioned in the beginning, in yes. Quality and in responsiveness. Yes. You also mentioned personnel competence and motivation. Do you see any improvements there?
We are doing yearly these employee satisfaction questionnaires, and there are motivation, empowerment indexes and those things there. And we do see an improvement in that area, not a drastic one, because this, I think, and it's maybe also part on the of the Finnish nature that you don't want to openly tell that you are happy because it might lead to something. Well, that's maybe the more kind of subject way of seeing it is just if you walk around in the premises and see what's going on in the team rooms, you can see kind of more smiling faces and a different way of working together compared with walking in the old corridors with closed doors, serious faces staring alone at the screen. Now you have a little bit even smiling faces looking at the same whiteboard, doing exactly the same thing as you earlier, but in a different way.
Is there any lessons you've learned?
There's been a lot of ups and downs, and even if we did involve quite early quite many people, if we would do it again, we understood that we should involve even more people even more early and put even more focus on creating the joint understanding for what's going on, what's happening, what shall we do. Creating the alignment within the organization about how we think about things, what our way of working, how we want to evolve it. The more you can spend on that, the more power you will get from below in the organization that is materialized through independent actions, spontaneous actions that support the vision and the goal. If you don't have the common alignment on the thinking of where you're going, the actions might lead in wrong directions, or probably more common, they will not come at all because nobody dares to move because they assume that somebody is supposed to tell me what to do. Really, really spend time on coaching, the leadership aspect, involving people, creating the right thinking and the room and the courage in the organization to do things. I think there's this pyramid of being very transparent, and this creates trust that gives you a courage to really act. And this again then will lead to good actions and good results.
Given the chance, would you go back to the waterfall model?
Absolutely not to that kind of a world from where we come. I guess some credit maybe should be given to the waterfall model. There are situations where it's probably good to do a bit more thinking, a bit more planning up front and creating some kind of overall architecture, especially if you start doing something completely new. That's not really doable in a pure Scrum 2-week sprint. You need an architecture in place. You need some basic building blocks. You need maybe one borderline there is when you have something that you can run in a continuous integration machinery and get continuous feedback, something that is up and running and testable to a certain level. Before you are there, the agile lean thinking, yes, will help you there, and it's good to have in the back pocket, but you cannot really run sprints in a clever way without that. So you need to build the basis first, and then I guess waterfall thinking to some extent would be needed there.
There are situations in which there is more need for upfront planning than what the basic agile model tells you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
What does lean mean here at Ericsson?
I guess lean means many things. I think right now, Ericsson, if it would pick one thing that Ericsson is focusing on when it comes to lean, it's kind of understanding the consequences from going from a resource optimization world to a value and flow optimization world. When looking at only R&D internal piece of the end-to-end flow, it means something. But if you optimize only that, you are not maybe enterprise level lean. So you need to build out the full understanding to the whole end-to-end flow. Ericsson with over 100,000 employees, and you have 10 regions with big number of market units per country coming with the customer interface and the input from the markets. We have a business units, product management, kind of gathering that to requirements, feeding into an R&D machinery. R&D machinery spitting out a product that needs support, it needs training, it needs supply, it needs manufacturing, it needs the whole shebang. It becomes not very obvious how to optimize this piece of the flow in the R&D. The whole Ericsson company is kind of waking up to this reality and really starting to challenging the status quo. Of course, Ericsson has been around for a while, and meaning that we cannot have been all that bad in doing all these things, but see more and more kind of possibilities to do things differently.
So would it be fair to say that also the change, the transformation you have done here in Finland is kind of a best case within Ericsson?
I would be a bit careful with using the word best, but definitely one of the first, this broad case where we have taken the thinking this far. Similar and same changes are happening all around the company. Some organizations have come roughly equally as far as we. Some are just in the beginning. We have been a role example, a model. Many other Ericsson organizations have been visiting us during the last couple 2 years. We have really a good reputation within Ericsson when it comes to this transformation. But good things are happening all around the company at the moment. And there's really big kind of energy behind this change. Still, it will take a lot of time.
Okay, thank you very much, Christian, for talking to me about this very impressive transformation. And I wish you the best of luck with the full-scale rollout and all the future improvements that you're going to make. Thank you.